From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, Pakistani journalist and bureau chief for the Asia Times, Salim Shahzad, published a story about an alleged al-Qaeda infiltration in the Pakistani Navy. He wrote the story after a naval base in Pakistan's south was attacked by al-Qaeda insurgents who claimed to be seeking revenge for the killing of Osama bin Laden. 2 days after his story was published, Shahzad was abducted from his home. This Tuesday, he was found dead in a canal with marks of torture on his body. Journalists in Pakistan are blaming the country's intelligence service, the ISI, for Shahzad's killing. Freelance journalist Shahan Mufti says that Shahzad's killing is part of a larger war that's being waged in Pakistan.
This war is being fought not between two parties, but many parties. It is being fought on one hand by militants, and on the other hand by a couple of intelligence agencies. So the Pakistani intelligence agency is involved. It has its hands deep in this war. The CIA, who's carrying out the drone campaign and has foot soldiers in Pakistan, they're deeply involved in this. And so in this war, information and free information, misinformation become very potent tools. And I think that's the context in which this journalist has turned up dead.
But even as they're in the crosshairs of this war, news outlets and journalists put themselves at risk from the very organizations that provide the bulk of their information. For instance, Salim Shahzad had sources deep within the ISI, the military, and within al-Qaeda, right?
That's correct, especially in that northwestern part of Pakistan where the war is at its hottest. That is an area that journalists don't have direct access to. They are banned from going into those areas. So these journalists are deeply dependent on the ISI, deeply dependent on the militants, and deeply dependent on any official body for their source of information.
But it doesn't prevent them from being targeted by those organizations.
No. Like any relationship with such an intelligence or any institution, there is a power relationship which keeps shifting. And this is all happening at a moment when the journalists were in a power position after the death of Osama bin Laden. They felt like they had the freedom to lambast the military, the intelligence agencies, for their failures and bring their failures to light.
Why did they feel they had the freedom?
With the killing of Osama bin Laden, the military had to come out and apologize for it. And I think that moment of weakness is what stimulated
it. Emboldened reporters?
Yeah, it did.
Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton declared that the U.S. would support the Pakistani government's efforts to investigate the killing. At the same time, the U.S. gives billions of dollars in aid each year to Pakistan's military and security apparatus who are implicated in the killing. So how does the U.S. square that circle?
The intelligence agencies are not admitting to it. In a very rare public statement, they have actually denied that they killed this journalist. Usually when there's question marks around intelligence agencies' involvement with the killing of a journalist, they usually say nothing because they don't have to. So this time, at least a day later,
they took the trouble to deny it.
But how much pressure they're going to face from the United States, unfortunately, I don't think there's going to be much pressure because the United States government, State Department, has very little leverage over the Pakistani army and Pakistani intelligence services, despite the aid that goes there.
If this is a war fought among the ISI, the military, al-Qaeda, American intelligence, what are they fighting for?
This is really the question around the American relationship with Pakistan. What is this American relationship with Pakistan? Why does America seem incapable of letting go of Pakistan? It all has to do with creating an environment in that region that can help bring the war to an end at this point in Afghanistan.
And Pakistan has its own agenda vis-a-vis India and therefore does not align with the American position.
Exactly. That is what we keep talking about when we talk about a double game, that Pakistan's playing a double game with the United States. It's really this idea that Pakistan is trying to make sure that India is contained and that Afghanistan remains a friendly country to Pakistan. And to this end, the Pakistani military intelligence outfits are carrying out their own war in the region, sometimes against the CIA and the United States, sometimes with the CIA and the United States, sometimes against India, sometimes with Afghanistan, sometimes against it. And in this incredible fog, journalists are trying to bring out this very, very complicated truth.
And as so many of them get picked off, do Do you see the information just closing down, or will there still be some sort of way to look into the murk?
There is a tradition of a free media in Pakistan. There is a tradition of an independent media, print media in Pakistan. Recently, there is a tradition of an independent television media in Pakistan as well. But if you are a journalist reporting in Pakistan on sensitive issues, you're used to your phone being tapped and you're used to being trailed and followed around. But somehow the information keeps coming out of Pakistan. And I think that while this death will have a chilling effect on the media, there's also possible, because of the amount of attention this has attracted, that this will be used by the media as another way to point out the weaknesses in its military and its human rights record in Pakistan.
A lot of the pundit class in the U.S. think that the death of Osama bin Laden represents a kind of closure. You suggest that it's opened a whole new chapter of violence. Apparently it has. Are we not paying enough attention?
I think at the end of the day, we should be asking ourselves, what is all of this for? Who is the United States helping by being involved in this war? And I think those are the kinds of questions that might one day save the life of somebody like Salim Shahzad.
Don't we need to prevent a safe haven being created for terrorists in Afghanistan?
Yes. And I think that the neighbors of Afghanistan are going to have to deal with that question long after the United States is out of that country. That is in the interest of a lot of countries in the region. And it seems less and less that the United States is going to have any real role to play in peace in Afghanistan and Pakistan in the long run.
Shahan Mufti, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Shahan Mufti is a freelance journalist and a former correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Pakistan. On Thursday, a 37-year-old Chechen man named Rustam Mahmudov was indicted for the murder of investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who was shot dead in the entrance of her apartment building in 2006. Politkovskaya was renowned for her courage. She opposed Russia's war in Chechnya. She wrote about human rights abuses by Russian military forces and by Chechen rebels. She was loathed by both sides. The Putin Kremlin downplayed her role. Vladimir Putin said that although she was known throughout the world, in Russia, Politkovskaya was not very influential. And as in the case of virtually all murders of journalists in Russia, the prosecution against the accomplices to Politkovskaya's murder fell apart. But current president Dmitry Medvedev has vowed to do better. So eyes are on the upcoming prosecution of Rustam Mahmudov.
Obviously, the Mahmudovs are only links in the chain, and their indictment and their successful conviction is only a stepping stone towards full justice in this crime and other crimes against journalists.
When you consider the history of nations and the formation of democracy, where would you put Russia, say, in comparison to Pakistan? I mean, when you look at the death of Salim Shahzad and the death of Politkovskaya, do you see Russia as being ahead of Pakistan in terms of developing the system of justice and the incentive to pursue these cases?
Well, the Committee to Protect Journalists just published our so-called Impunity Index that compiles a list of countries where journalists are killed and their killers remain at large. In this list, Iraq is the country where killers have gone unpunished most often. Somalia is number two. The Philippines are number three. Sri Lanka is fourth. Colombia is fifth. Afghanistan is the sixth. Nepal is the seventh. Mexico is the eighth, and Russia comes as number nine in this list. Russia is in the company as well of Pakistan, Bangladesh, Brazil, and India. CPJ's Impunity Index calculates the number of unsolved journalist murders as a percentage of each country's population. And for this index, CPJ examines journalist murders that occurred between January 2001 through December 31st, 2010, and that remain unsolved.
So CPJ doesn't see a big distinction then between Russia and Pakistan?
No, in fact, Russia is number nine in the index and Pakistan is number 10.
How does the murder of journalists accord with the murder of civilians generally?
Well, it's interesting that by the admission of Russia's law enforcement, 80% of murders at large in Russia are solved. Now, compare that with the 90-something percent of killings of journalists that remain unsolved. Journalists are being targeted because they are the diggers of inconvenient and embarrassing truths, and they pay the ultimate price.
We talked to a human rights activist a few years back in Moscow, and he had no faith at all in Russian justice. Do you?
Back in 2009, CPJ published a report called Anatomy of Injustice, the Unsolved Killings of Journalists in Russia. And we discovered that investigations fall apart at every level, from the detectives' work to the prosecution, to the judiciary, a lack of transparency, an absence of accountability, susceptibility to external influences, and an inability to pursue cases to their conclusion.
So are you more hopeful now?
Well, we are an advocacy group, and we will always be hopeful that things can change for the better. I think what could turn the tide is a combination of public interest, more thorough work from the investigation, better political will to see these cases to their completion, and the involvement of the international community. We have seen that all of these factors can make a difference.
Nina, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nina Ognyanova is the program coordinator in Europe and Central Asia for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She joined us from Moscow.
Coming up, a changing of the guard at the New York Times. Meet the guardsmen.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When President Obama proposed his health care plan to Congress roughly 2 years ago, it included a provision for Medicare to pay for the visits of patients opting to discuss their end-of-life care with a doctor. That small part of the health care bill snowballed into a major controversy when Sarah Palin dubbed it a death panel. PolitiFact quickly debunked the false claim of death panels, even as the media covered the issue incessantly, with more than 800 related articles appearing in newspapers around the country. Dr. Regina Lawrence is a professor at Louisiana State University's Mann Shipp School of Mass Communications, where she and a colleague recently presented a paper analyzing how the media covered the death panel claim.
When we began this study, gosh, 2 years ago now almost, we went in with the assumption that news stories would either debunk the claim in some way, or they would do he said, she said. What we actually found is that in a fair number of stories, they did both, and we weren't prepared to find that. You had a fair number of stories.
I'm sorry. You're saying that there would be a paragraph that says the sky is not brown, and then they would go to the brown camp and get a quote from them. The sky is indeed brown.
Yes, yes, and that was one predominant pattern in the coverage.
Permit me to play devil's advocate here.
Please.
On the face of it would seem that having debunked the claim, it is a pointless, even silly, even dangerous exercise to give airing to the opposing view. On the other hand, there's the question at hand, are there death panels? Is there climate change? Do vaccines cause autism in children? These have been settled scientifically, but the political controversy does continue. So aren't journalists stuck if they ignore the political controversy? Perhaps they're abdicating their responsibility to report the underlying politics.
I think that you're right, and that's exactly the dilemma that we wanted to illuminate in this paper, that journalists are stuck, as you put it. There's even a trap there, if you will, because if a policymaker or a politician wants to make news, it's pretty easy to do so with one of these very controversial claims that is sure to get news attention. And once others begin talking about it, particularly in this case, you have the president, prominent members of Congress, all then reacting and trying to either promote the death panel's notion or, you know, knock it down, as the president himself did in a number of town hall meetings. Once you've got that going on, what is an objective reporter to do? Because after all, one of the leading definitions of news really in practice is what powerful people are saying. That's the news.
What if I said to you that whatever journalistic solution is finally embraced matters not at all? Because other academics have shown again and again two things. Number one, the more we hear the claim debunked, the more we believe the original misinformation. And the second academic revelation, that we tend to believe whatever we wish to believe, irrespective of the available facts.
It's also important to remember, though, that's one part of the audience. There's still a big middle out there which is not so polarized, which is not so defined by predispositions that you can't reach them. And for that middle, I think it's the repetition that's especially problematic, because for that middle that maybe has less political knowledge and less political views to guide them, they just hear death panels, death panels, death panels. And for them, the outcome can be, oh, there must be something to this death panels business.
You studied newspapers, and not cable news, for example. But one of the problems in the daily newspaper business is it's daily and it's transitory, and that once you cover a story and there's nothing further to add, that's that. So once you do the PolitiFact due diligence and print it in the newspaper, that's taken care of, but these supposed controversies tend to be ongoing, and you can't continue to run the same PolitiFact debunking every time the subject comes up. Or can you? Should you? Should there be some sort of, I don't know, graphic device that says, you know, the story has already been deemed to be just so much nonsense?
That's an interesting point. Would it be possible to have that little sort of, you know, informational fact box, if you will, sitting beside each one of these stories that are talking about something like death panels, which is relatively easy to debunk?
Truth in Labeling. The issue being discussed by these politicians has been determined by PolitiFact to be a big bunch of baloney.
It would have to be a little bit more involved than that, I would think, if you really wanted it to be useful. But you could provide a paragraph or so with the address of a website to go to learn more.
Can you give me one reason why I shouldn't be just curled up in a fetal position and sobbing?
I really think, I mean, don't you? Journalism is at a key moment of crisis, obviously, economically, but also in terms of figuring out what the model is for news in the future. This might be a great starting point for thinking about how do you break out of those tried and true formulas of just covering what the politicians are saying and doing the he said, she said. Isn't this a great opportunity to break out of that and find news that people will find more useful and that hopefully they'll find more interesting and will tune into?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Regina Lawrence is a professor of mass communications at LSU's Manship School of Mass Communication.
Last week, French President Nicolas Sarkozy invited a group of world leaders and technology executives to the first ever EG8. A forum to discuss the future of the internet and global public policy. It was an invitation-only summit that included Google's executive chairman Eric Schmidt and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. But some invitees refused to attend in protest of the forum. Jeff Jarvis is the director of the Tau Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York. He also was invited to the EG8 and, though suspicious of the French president's intentions, decided to check it out, despite the reservations of some of his colleagues who worried
that we would all be a smokescreen for Sarkozy's attempt to govern the internet. I decided to go see the devil first out and see if I could get my say in.
You didn't prejudge this by assuming he'd be the devil?
Oh, I think that all of us net people think that government attempts to regulate us are devilish attempts.
What were the policies being pushed by the forum?
Sarkozy wants to regulate the internet. He said in the past that he wants to civilize the internet. And he thinks about this as a way to bring law and order to this strange new world. What gives the net its own sovereignty is that no one has sovereignty over it.
You believe that governments have no sovereignty on the net because there is no consent of the governed, because there is no governed there.
We are first already governed in real life by whatever lands we live in. It is already illegal to put out child pornography. Do you need new laws just for the internet to deal with that? I don't think so. If we allow any government to come in and take control of the internet, we allow every government to do so. If France claims the right to have authority over the internet, then China will claim the same right. And we end up with the worst of all the regulation possible in the world.
So the fundamental principle that governments should have a say, you object to.
I stood up to Sarkozy and suggested myself that he take a Hippocratic oath for the internet. That is, first, do no harm. And he mocked that at first in a wonderfully Gaelic way. And he said, is it harm for us to protect your children from pornography? Is it harm for us to protect you from terrorism? Is it harm for us to protect your intellectual property? I don't think so. And he said, I'll take your oath. That's no problem. But then he finally turned around and did acknowledge that this internet is new. I liken the internet to the Gutenberg press. And the power and impact on society, while I think will be at least as great. But it took 50 years for the book to come into its own form, 100 years before it affected society in ways we can recognize. By that reckoning, we are now at the year 1467 in the life of the internet. We don't know what it is yet.
What is the EG8's proposed internet policy? Does it have one, or did it simply assert at this meeting that it ought to have one?
Sarkozy wanted to put the internet onto the agenda of the G8 to say that governments have a role in the internet. That government, in his view, is the only legitimate representative of the people in a democracy, to which I say that to the people of Tahrir Square. That, no, governments are not necessarily our spokesmen. Governments do not necessarily have this authority. This is a future to be invented. That scares governments, because governments become less important. Nations become less important. And Sarkozy, whether he knows it or not, I think sees that danger. I don't think that it's wrong for government to talk about this and to have a voice in this. Same with corporations, same with civic organizations. The problem was this meeting was held at government's table. Better if netizens got together and had a meeting and invited the government and these corporations to their table. And it's our loss that we didn't. It was good to go because one wants to face one's fears. I came away from the EG8 afraid of the people who are afraid of the internet. They want to stop it. They want to change it. It's not even fully birthed yet, and we have to let the baby grow.
You say the whole thing was a great pity that this meeting was called and that netizens have only themselves to blame. They are absent.
Well, they were absent from the EG8 because Sarkozy didn't invite them and because, as Laurent Slesik said, they didn't know how to get invited. And as Susan Crawford, a law professor here in New York, said, the important thing about being there was to demonstrate that there is not consensus, Monsieur le Président, that we don't agree with what you say, and you can't just go and act as if you pulled together the internet and got them all to agree that you're welcome here. They were trying to negotiate with the future of the internet, but the internet wasn't there. The people who are really the future of the internet are not Google and Facebook, but some kid out there who's going to disrupt them all. And the internet allows them to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Jarvis is the director of the Tau Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York. On Thursday, New York Times executive editor Bill Keller announced he'd be stepping down in September to write full-time for the paper. He'll be replaced by Jill Abramson, who, as managing editor, was instrumental in creating the recently implemented paywall and has worked to push the newsroom and the paper's website closer together. Abramson will be replaced by assistant managing editor Dean Baquet. I spoke with both Keller and Abramson shortly after the announcement as they were headed to an afternoon editorial meeting. I asked Keller if he felt a sense of utter liberation.
Not utter, no. I mean, I think I'll probably feel more liberated as time passes, but it was a fairly emotional scene. And I look around the newsroom and up at the balconies, and there are all these people. Some of them are sort of friends in the Facebook sense of the word, and some of them are friends in the genuine, you love these people sense of the word. And I'm going to miss them.
You took over from Howell Raines after the Jason Blair affair. You had to get the ship somewhat righted. You also issued the editor's note, the apology for the coverage of the war.
Mm-hmm. I think both Jill and I would probably put that at the top of our list of things we wish we'd done differently. That is to say, that we wish we'd done sooner. I think it would have been wiser and healthier for the paper and its credibility if I'd taken that bull by the horns first thing and said, you know what, we screwed up here. And the way we screwed up was we fell too hard for the conventional wisdom about Saddam Hussein. And we let some of the reporting run a little wild.
I completely agree.
Jill, the paper will stay fundamentally the same, but you'll both have very different leadership styles.
Well, I would take issue with your premise because Bill and I have worked very closely as a team for 8 years, and we have differences, but I think our strengths have complemented one another.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what I was simply asking was how that style might change now that you won't have the same complementary relationship.
Well, that is part of the reason that I was drawn to select Dean as managing editor. I feel we have certain of the same journalistic passions and that in terms of our leadership styles, we will complement one another.
You know, Brooke, the thing I think people often don't get about newspapers, and it's maybe different from magazines. A magazine tends to take a shape around the personality of the editor. Newspapers are really such collective ventures. I mean, yes, you get extreme cases where you have a particularly authoritarian editor or an editor with a, God forbid, a unvarnished political bias. But in most cases, and I think this is a good thing, newspapers are way too big and too complicated to be run or dominated by any one person. Most of the stuff flows up from the bottom, from the field. Most of what goes into the paper every day, Jill and I see when it's in the paper or on the website. We have certain levers that we hold, including the choice of what stories go on the front page, how something is going to be played on the homepage. We get to play a role in deciding, you know, who's going to be the correspondent on X beat or in X country. But to a degree that I think would surprise most people, you know, the temperament and the passions of the top person at a place like the New York Times are diffused and balanced by a whole lot of other people around you.
I do remember that there were a lot of reports from inside contrasting your style with that of Howell Raines, who gave the editors beneath him far less freedom to make their decisions.
That's true. And I kind of had that in mind when I prefaced it by saying that there are exceptions. You know, there are editors whose personality is so forceful for good or for ill that the whole place tends to move accordingly. But that's mostly not the case, and I think has not been the case under me and Jill, and probably won't be under Jill and Dean.
Jill, you said that this was a dream job.
Yeah, it is.
Working alongside Bill all these years, do you feel like he was in a dream?
He was having a very interesting and good time.
Except when he wasn't.
Except when he wasn't. And it's a dream job because you are dealing with very important stories and making very critical judgment calls about when they're ready to be published. And it's so stimulating, even while being stressful.
What about the girl thing? You feel any pressure there?
No, I feel pride in the girl thing. You know, I'm proud to be the first woman executive editor, as I was happy to be the first woman Washington bureau chief. And, you know, I, in fact, wrote a Week in Review piece when Katie Couric was named anchor. And the point of my piece is, like, when will we get to the point when people aren't fixating on the first woman, this or that. You know, in some ways we're there, and from the number of messages I've gotten from other women journalists, it seems like it's a big day.
I think it was The Observer that said Jill was more alpha.
Yeah, they did. You know, if that comment is sort of suggesting that the role of a woman editor should not be alpha, that she should be the one who dispenses Band-Aids and makes people feel better all the time and pats them on the head, that feels like a little bit of a dated stereotype. I mean, mm-hmm. Jill is a dogged, tough-minded editor with a great deal of spine. She will stand up to her bosses. I can tell you that from personal experience. If reporters have not gotten to the bottom of a story and she can see where the bottom is, she will get them there. I mean, this is a woman who, you know, was run over by a truck a few years ago. And, you know, the truck lost.
Jill Abramson will take over as executive editor of the New York Times this September when Bill Keller steps down to write full-time for the paper.
Coming up, is it somebody else's intellectual property if it's on your face?
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling reputations at Reputation.com. On the Media is also supported by the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at Kauffman.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Boxer Mike Tyson was intimidating before he got a Maori-inspired tattoo on his face. With it, his stopping power almost KO'd a $110 million film. The artist who created the Tyson tattoo tried but failed to block Warner Brothers from releasing the new movie, The Hangover Part 2, claiming copyright infringement because one of the film's characters, played by Ed Helms, wakes up from a drunken night of partying inked exactly like Tyson.
It's not coming off! This is a real tattoo! Alan, what did you do? Did you roofie me?
I didn't do anything.
Stu, he swore to God.
The judge on the case decided too many people would be harmed financially if the film weren't released, but did find that the artist might have a legitimate copyright claim and would likely win monetary damages at trial. James Boyle, professor at Duke University School of Law, says the case could have set a worrisome precedent. James, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So the judge says, no, we're going to let this film be released, but there's something here. What's here?
Copyright is supposed to cover any kind of pictorial, graphic, written, musical expression that's original and that's fixed in material form. So the argument is, well, if you put it on canvas, it would be copyrightable. If you put it on paper, it would be copyrightable. Why isn't it copyrightable when you put it on human skin? The more disturbing question is, first, whether or not we want copyright law to cover portions of the human body. Is that actually what we mean by a tangible medium of expression? Is that what Congress would have wanted? Is that what we want? Secondly, if we do, what kind of control does that give the person who creates the tattoo? Are they going to be able to tell me not to be filmed, not to have someone take a picture of me? After all, those would be copies of the copy. Can you imagine someone telling you that you actually can't show your face in front of any recording device? It's those kinds of dystopian musings that have a number of people disturbed.
I just want to clarify, this case came up not because of Mike Tyson's tattoo, but because of the fake tattoo on Ed Helms in the movie. In the first film with Mike Tyson and his tattoo, this didn't come up because...
The tattoo artist and Mr. Tyson had actually concluded an agreement which allowed Mr. Tyson to wear the tattoo in public, be photographed, and so forth. So Mr. Tyson already had a release.
This is a comedy, and one area where the courts have been quite liberal is on the subject of satire. You're allowed to parody. You're allowed to do satire with wide berth on fair use. Could they not have taken the parody exemption and ended this discussion at the beginning?
The difficulty is, what's actually happening here? Is this a criticism of Mike Tyson or of Mike Tyson's tattoo? Or is he using this tattoo in order to make a completely different point about the very dumb things that people do when they're drunk? If the court thought it was the latter, then they might be less inclined to think that it was a fair use, even though it's clearly transformative. They put it in a new context. They changed it. If, on the other hand, they were taking aim at the original or mocking it, then the courts are generally more hospitable. And there's a sort of gray line in between. Someone tried to take Dr. Seuss's poem, One Fish, Two Fish, and turn it into a poem about the O.J. Simpson trial. Instead of One Fish, Two Fish, it went, one knife, two wife, red knife, dead wife. The court, when presented with the fair use argument there, said, no, you're not commenting on Dr. Seuss. You're using Dr. Seuss to comment on O.J. Simpson. Is that the way the court would see it in this case? Or would they say, no, actually, he is kind of making fun of this practice of tattooing your face. And for that purpose, he actually needed Mike Tyson's tattoo.
Am I nuts, or is this case kind of an analog version of the notion of sampling, which we often deal with in the digital context and in hip-hop, for example? But now, instead of notes of music, we're talking about tattoo ink.
I think in a way it is. I mean, one question is, what can you quote from the culture around you? A lot of that culture, music, pictures, posters, and so forth, tattoos, may be covered by copyrights. What can you quote? Hip-hop samplers would like to be able to quote small, highly transformed fragments of other songs in their music. But a series of court decisions have thrown doubt on that and said, so the courts have said things like, no amount of music above one note is too small to count as potential copyright infringement. Get a license or do not sample. The question I ask myself is, if we'd applied those kinds of rules, the same thought patterns, to the development of jazz in the 1930s or 1910, would we have had jazz? Because after all, jazz is all about quoting tiny fragments of other people's tunes, and that's what makes it an art form. If we're doing the kinds of things which would make today's equivalent of jazz illegal, then I think we're making a mistake. Of course, the tattoo artist would say, this isn't about jazz, it's just about somebody ripping off my copyrighted original work. But still, the tendency is a disturbing one.
Okay, I'm just going to stay away from the tattoo parlor and the lawyer if it's all the same to you. James, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
James Boyle is a professor of law at the Duke University School of Law. America's Most Wanted, the TV show that profiles fugitives and asks the public to help catch them, later this month ends its 23 years as a regular series on Fox. The creators believe their legacy is the roster of more than 1,100 fugitives the show has helped put into police custody. But Slate's Chris Beam focuses on another achievement, making the dramatic crime reenactment a television fixture. You've seen this stuff, grainy or jumpy footage of anonymous actors portraying victims and perpetrators as a grim narrator describes the action.
After making sure Ronnie Carpenter had left for work, deputies say Rusty Garrett waited several hours for Linda to come out.
Rusty?
These disturbing portrayals either accurately reflect what took place during the crime or get it all wrong. But if the technique is dubious, Chris Beam says it also has a long history.
Back during the days of Jack the Ripper in London, the famous illustrated London dailies would have engravings every morning depicting either the crime or the police looking for the victim or discovering the victim. You know, newsreels in the 1930s would have reenactments as we imagine them today. So it is a technique that's been around for a long time. They want to pull readers in and, more than anything, make them feel like they're there. They're seeing the killer. They're seeing the gun go off. And it's funny, when you see a reenactment, you know it's a reenactment, but nonetheless, it makes the event itself feel more real. And for America's Most Wanted, especially, that's important because their goal is to track down these killers, these criminals. And so to make the audience feel like they're invested in the crime is especially important.
The reenactment has become such a staple of cable TV true crime stuff that is just everywhere. But what I was really stunned by in reading your piece was that this stuff shows up not only in crime entertainment, but actually in courts.
Most recently, there's been a trend towards digital reenactments. So lawyers, either for the defense or for the prosecution, will commission a 3D animation of what they think happened. And this is controversial because some lawyers have argued that it biases the jury. Seeing something depicted so realistically in a 3D animation is more likely to make them believe whoever commissioned the animation. So sometimes you'll have a defense and a prosecution with dueling animations of each side's version of events.
That's glitzy 3D reenactments. In some places in court, they actually make the defendant walk through a live reenactment of the crime, or at least the prosecution's version of the crime.
Yeah, this still happens to this day in South Korea. If you're accused of a crime, the police will sometimes force you to reenact the alleged crime. They'll invite the media, they'll let the public watch as you go through step by step what you're accused of doing, anything from robbery to murder or rape. The justification is that this will help the police verify your confession if you confess. But there's also an element of public shaming. It's part of your punishment.
Errol Morris, in his famous documentary, The Thin Blue Line, actually presented multiple reenactments of the same crime. Tell me about that.
The case involved the murder of a Texas policeman in the 1980s, I believe, and different people had different versions of the story. And so the way Errol Morris handled that was that he reenacted each version of the story according to people's version of events. What's so brilliant about it is that it undermines the notion that there is one definitive version of the crime. You know, you're constantly reminding yourself that what you're seeing is not to be trusted. And most cop shows, you know, most programs like America's Most Wanted don't do that. They want you to be immersed. They don't want you to be critical of what you're seeing.
Should we feel queasy about buying into this trope? Are you really confident that the public comes away not assuming that they have just witnessed reality?
You know, Errol Morris has written that he was once asked how he managed to be there at the scene of the crime in Dallas in the 1980s. And he just looked at the guy blankly. He's like, you don't realize that this is a reenactment? So there's always going to be an audience that doesn't distinguish there. But I think we shouldn't be troubled because I don't think that reenactments, as done on America's Most Wanted, are really in the end different from etchings in the 19th century, from pamphlets in the 17th century. You know, this is how we tell stories. We select certain facts, we pick a version of events, and they're not making this up out of whole cloth. They're basing these reenactments on police reports. I think that as long as they're clear about what the audience is watching, I think it's a perfectly fine practice.
Okay, Chris. Well, thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You can find Chris Beam's story, Repeat Offenders, at Slate.com. Of course, sometimes the victims and perpetrators in TV crime shows are the actual victims and perpetrators. Here's a piece I did back in 2001.
North Carolina, 1994. Officers find themselves against an enraged man with a shotgun. It's a delicate matter, but one the police are equipped to handle.
The show is called World's Wildest Police Videos. The image is a shotgun-wielding man, shirtless on his porch, raving at police. He has gotten himself stinking blotto. He has done violence in his household. Now he is making terrorist threats and a total jackass of himself for all his neighbors and a few million others to see. Renee Less can scarcely believe her good fortune.
It's just this big, fat guy on his porch raving with an enormous gun, and they're all shirtless. None of them are wearing shirts.
She is lucky because in addition to having no shirts, the shotgun-wielding porch stander honors of this nation also have no shame. This man signed a release permitting World's Wildest Police Videos to broadcast his image, and the owner of most every other unobscured face you see on these gritty police reality shows has done the same thing. Lesk is in charge of obtaining these releases. She is awash in 8x11 forms, ready to be stuffed into dozens and dozens of thick vinyl binders.
There's an alternate paper universe that agrees with the visual universe that you look at every day.
But why? Why let some TV producer trade in your personal humiliation? Fred Heilbrunn, a permissions specialist who has obtained nearly 10,000 releases for such shows as True Stories of the Highway Patrol, offers a number of explanations, from malignant macho to civic mindedness to, every so often, cash money. But it is still hard for him to believe how easy it is. Once, he says, he was with a camera crew at a heroin bust, and one of the suspects bolted directly toward them.
The cameraman, who was built like a halfback, steps out. The suspect falls backward into a wall, and the cameraman sticks the camera in this fella's face. And then the cameraman follows it up by saying, "Don't move or I'll shoot you." And the fella threw his hands up in the air and complied like the cameraman had an MP5 pointed at the guy's head. It was just amazing.
Did you approach him to sign a release?
Oh, yeah. And he signed.
To Rene Lesk, the stop or I'll shoot gambit suggests another possibility for suspects' willingness to sign on the dotted line, the confusion over who is a cop and who isn't, and maybe the hope that cooperation with the camera crew will yield softer treatment from the police down the line. Fred Heilbrunn says cultivating that confusion is unethical, and often enough, he says, an opposite force may be at work.
They found out that when the police come through your door, you know, knock it off its hinges, come barreling through, throw you into the wall, handcuff you, and then somebody walks up and says, "Hi, my name's Fred. Has anybody told you what the cameras are about?" The people relaxed.
Bad cop, good producer.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, I learned some of my techniques from watching the police work.
One thing that all release getters quickly learn is that the culture of reality television, and the culture in general, work in their favor. In this society, appearing on television is deemed an achievement in its own right, and neither the subjects nor the audience seem to be all that concerned about how that is achieved. You know, "Hey, Tony, I saw you on TV. Was that your shotgun? What happened to your shirt?"
I think my favorite was a fella who, to pay off a debt to a dealer, offered his barn to be set up as a meth lab. The way the police found out about him was his electric bill, which should have been perhaps $150 a month, was something like $10,000 a month, and he wasn't paying it.
As police raided the barn, the guy quickly grabbed a guitar and started singing.
When I told him what I wanted, he said, "Will you show me singing?" And I said, "If you'd like." And he signed the release.
No matter that he faced 20 years in prison.
He wanted to be sure that he was going to have at least 10 seconds of himself singing on a national television show, so we gave that to him.
How was the song?
It was terrible. Just terrible. I think, if I recall, he was doing like Puff the Magic Dragon, and just, Joe, it was just awful.
There's yet another category, the chastened criminal who wants to steer others away from foolish choices. Lesk's biggest coup was getting a release from a woman arrested for DWI who was taped for an hour making sexual advances on the arresting officer.
"I can't help it, but I just know you're good looking.
I appreciate that, okay?
I know,
but
you feel
it
right around.
Right there, okay?
Outside.
Thank you, ma'am."
That was, as they say, this lady's rock bottom, and she was persuaded that making herself a laughingstock on television was an appropriate way to begin her new life of sobriety. But of all the explanations for why Lesk's vinyl binders are so full, maybe the best is the most obvious.
Criminals are stupid.
And the best illustration is a piece of tape aired on her show for which no release was necessary because the suspect's face was not visible.
"We saw a guy walk into a convenience store with a paper bag over his head. No holes. You know, he was obviously having some trouble seeing. And he tried to rob it, and it was so, he seemed so ineffectual because of the paper bag and the no holes, that the clerk didn't really understand that he was seriously trying to rob him, and he didn't have a weapon. So the clerk just said, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. And the guy with the bag on his head just walked away. Criminals are stupid. They're criminals because they're stupid. Their stupidity puts them in jail. Their stupidity keeps them in jail. When they get out of jail, their stupidity puts them back in jail. Criminals are stupid.
So what you're suggesting is, if I can read between the lines here, you're suggesting, and don't let me, please, put words in your mouth, that criminals are stupid.
That's what I'm saying.
As for the zeitgeist image of the shirtless ruffian on his porch raving,
Lesk says, be not misled. There are no more of these people nowadays, she believes, than there ever were.
I think there are just more cameras. I got to tell you, I think the shirtless guy was raving at the police for our grandparents and our great-grandparents. But now there are cameras to capture it. They look for opportunities to capture it. Now we all see it. And the guy without the shirt doesn't mind. He wants his rants to be heard. He's perfectly happy with that development.
To waste our lives would be a sin.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Asia Boundawi, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.